Vom 11. Januar bis am 31. März 2024 sind die beiden großen Ausstellungen Techno Worlds und The Pulse of Techno zusammen mit einem umfassenden Begleitprogramm zu Besuch in der Fotobastei. Sie spüren den unterschiedlichsten Formaten und dem Facettenreichtum der Technokultur nach. Im Rahmen dieses Begleitprogramms finden zahlreiche Gesprächsrunden statt, von denen wir eine Auswahl auf Radio Lora 97,5 für euch übertragen. Im Anschluss hört ihr eine davon.
Michigan's first on WGPR, Michigan's first black-owned FM station, founded her own label, a DJ collective called WOW, which stands for the Movement Festival since pretty much the year 2000 onwards, and will be playing this year. And she had a big club hit called A Walk in the Park. We will talk about that later on. Not to be confused with the Nick Straker band Disco Tune from the late 70s, that's a different one. And more recently, a great track called Do It All Night on Carl Craig's Planet E imprint. And that's not even 10% of her story. Please welcome DJ Minx.
Thank you so much.
To my right, Cornelius. Born and grown up in Ann Arbor, Michigan. He earned a degree from the University of Michigan. He's actually been there, beautiful place. And although he had other plans, Corin, as his friends and associates called him, ended up in Detroit, reluctantly decided to manage artists rather than becoming one. So he acts as a label manager, a booking agent, a writer, and a cultural activist. No.
That works.
Okay. I forgot, sorry. I know he's a big fan of Yellow Magic Orchestra, especially the late musical genius Ryuichi Sakamoto, who passed away recently. And of course, he's the official spokesman for Underground Resistance. Please welcome Cornelius Harris. Last but not least, another Detroit original, but he's gone astray. he's a Berlin resident since 2013, imported from Detroit as the Chrysler advent, where he started drawing cartoons even as a kid, moving on to designing comic books, record covers for UR, for Jacks Up Records, and graphic novels, the latest of which you can see if you turn your head. Maybe we'll talk about that later too. Okay. And so please welcome Alan Oldham, AKA DJ 1000.
T-1000,
I'm sorry. Okay. And not to forget, Mike Banks is in the house, but he doesn't want to be on stage. But we have another special guest, a guy from Berlin who founded perhaps one of the leading techno clubs in Europe. Well, probably the leading techno club in Europe. He's Dimitri Hegemann, Tresor founder, who's gonna speak a little bit about the Detroit-Berlin connection. Dimmy.
Can you stand up?
Yes, please.
Yes.
Great. It's a long time ago that I was on stage, you know. The wild years a bit over. Early to bed is my mission now, before midnight. Okay, but I want, he asked me maybe to give a small explanation how Detroit came to Berlin. And they allowed me to speak in German.
Oh, okay.
Ich spreche alle Deutsch, nehme ich an. Okay, also es war wie ein Märchen, nein, vor langer, langer Zeit. Also es war, sage ich mal, in West-Berlin. Ich hatte ein kleines Label, das heißt Interfish Records, und ich war so mit einer britischen Band aus Sheffield, Clock TVA. Ich war in diesen sophisticated electronic stuff. Und dann habe ich diese Band nach Chicago lizenziert, und ich war noch nie in Amerika, so ungefähr bin ich da mal hingefahren zu Wax Tracks. Und ich hatte viel Zeit und der Mann von Backstrax, Jim Nash, sagte, hier ist ein Korb voller Demos, nimm dir was. Haben wir alle abgelehnt. Dann habe ich da reingefischt, wie in so ein Lotto, was. Und es gefiel mir gut, ich habe es angehört. War auch so eine Nummer drauf, 313. Hab dann mal angerufen, ja, hallo, ihr wisst, so ein kleines Label aus Deutschland. Eure Musik gefällt mir gut, hättet ihr Lust, das in Deutschland zu veröffentlichen? Und tatsächlich war das die Gruppe von Jeff Mills, die ist Final Cut. So geht's dann manchmal. Also I took this 87, 88 und wir haben dann 1990 ein Atonal-Festival gemacht. Das war so ein Brückenfestival. Da waren die Stars eigentlich das Publikum. Es war das erste Festival, wo in Berlin mal wieder Leute tanzten, so kam mir das vor. Und da kam Final Cut und Clock TVA und bei Final Cut war auch Jeff Mills dabei. Ich verstand, wie man Schallplatten herstellt. Und dann kam Mr. Gorbatschow und hat die Mauer sozusagen geöffnet und da begann eine neue Zeit in Berlin. Also Jeff hatte sich in der Zwischenzeit gelöst, ist nach Detroit zurückgegangen und hat dieses Kollektiv Underground Resistance gegründet. Und wir haben mit Freunden den Club Tresor aufgebaut. Und ich sagte, das war schon 1989, fiel die Mauer im November. Dann war alles wirklich wunderbar durcheinander. Also 1990 war ein großartiges Jahr, weil die DDR bestand noch, müsst ihr euch vorstellen. Die Mauer war offen, man konnte den Ostmark im Osten einkaufen. Und da war einfach eine unglaubliche aufregende Stimmung, eine gute Stimmung. Und ich weiß noch, ich hatte auch so eine Veranstaltung gemacht in der Humboldt-Universität, also in der Elite-Hochschule des Bauernstaates der DDR. Und kein Geringerer kam als Timothy Leary und machte dort eine Lecture vom Psychedelics to Cybernetics, also diese, unvorstellbar. Also wie das alles ging mit dem Audimax zu mieten, eine andere Story. Naja, jedenfalls 1991 haben wir dann diesen Raum gefunden, diesen alten Tresorraum des Kaufhaus Wertheims mitten in Berlin. Und das war ein Ort, der direkt an der Mauer lag. Also kein Zugang für Ostbürger, auch nicht für Westbissen worden. Weil der Osten braucht den Überblick, ob da jemand flüchten will. Aber der Keller war noch da. Und da haben wir diese Stahlkammer entdeckt, das war ein großes Glück. Also es war das ist ein Ort, hier passiert was Großartiges. Und wir hatten immer noch diese Verbindung nach Detroit. Freunde von uns, Mark Ernestus, der hatte das Hardwax, einen Schallplattenladen und so weiter. Die haben auch sehr viel Musik. Das ist so ein Ding irgendwie, das ist vielleicht wie Punk, das kommt und geht. Wir hatten vorher in Berlin Acid House noch so ein bisschen. Hausmusik war nicht so populär dort. Aber die Leute waren alle gespannt und warteten auf was Neues. Wir hatten zu der Zeit Hip-Rap-Musik, wir hatten Nirvana, wir hatten High, halt auf was Neues. Und dann kam das Neue. Dann sagte es bumm. Ich hatte dann in Detroit auch angerufen, ey, kommt doch mal rüber. Und dann kam Underground Resistance rüber. Robert Hood, Mike Banks, Jeff, dann der Prince of Techno Blake. Alle kamen, Eddie Falls, Juan Atkins. Es hieß dann immer Cash on Delivery. Die haben dann Musik mitgebracht, wir konnten das einkaufen und sie kamen nach Detroit, nach Berlin und waren völlig, völlig geschockt, wie kaputt das alles war. Vielleicht war das aber auch ein Bindeelement zwischen Detroit und Berlin. Wir hatten auch diese große Depression und wir hatten auch dieses Hoffnungslose in West-Berlin. Auch, ich erinnere mich wirklich an starke Heroinfälle dort in der Umgebung. Und Detroit war auch so kaputt irgendwie. Auch keine Hoffnung, auch Depression. Das hat uns irgendwie auch zusammengefügt. Jedenfalls legten die Jungs los und die Berliner staunten nicht schlecht, weil diese Generation Underground Resistance und die folgenden, die spielten eine Musik, die sich etwas abgrenzen von dieser ersten Generation wie Derek, ohne Melodien, und das erreicht auch sehr viele Leute aus den anderen Ländern, den Ostländern, die auch jetzt alle geöffnet waren. Viele sprachen kein Englisch zu der Zeit, die kamen dann in Bussen drüber, ihr müsst euch vorstellen, kein Internet, kein iPhone. Ja, sie kamen und dann ging was los und das war wirklich eine neue Zeit. Und dieser Einfluss dieser Nachtkultur, das will ich noch mitschließen, konnte sich auch nur durchsetzen, weil Berlin seit 1949 keine Sperrstunde hatte. Und das hatten die Amerikaner damals nach dem Krieg eingeleitet, die einzige Stadt gewesen. Deshalb entsprang plötzlich eine Nachtkultur, eine Clubkultur, jetzt seit über 30 Jahren, die inzwischen wirklich gewachsen ist. Wir haben fast 200 Spielstätten, 9000 Jobs. 1,5 Milliarden Umsatz. So, es gab so eine Studie mal darüber. Also ist ein Wirtschaftsfaktor geworden, die Nachtkultur. Und dank Gorbatschow, aber dank Mischig, suchen wir uns jetzt über, kommen so langsam ins biblische Alter, aber das, wir haben so eine Detroit-Berlin-Connection aufgebaut und wir engagieren uns dort in Detroit ein bisschen. Sie haben uns die Musik gegeben, wir haben versucht, was zurückzugeben, Strukturen, und haben dort auch mitgeholfen, ein Haus aufzubauen, die Underground Music Academy. Könnt ihr mal Instagram gucken, was da so los ist. Ja, ist eine sehr schöne Geschichte, kleine Geschichte. Wir konnten auch in Detroit ein bisschen ändern. Wir konnten da auch mit der Stadt so versuchen. Das ist nämlich das Problem dort. Die haben eine Sperrstunde um 2 Uhr. Und wir konnten versuchen, da drumherum irgendwie mit dem Bürgermeister zu verhandeln. Jedes Jahr hatten wir so eine kleine Konferenz, Potential, was ist hier möglich? Weil sie haben den Raum, sie haben die Musik. Detroit ist das Mecca of Music in America, denke ich. Aber sie haben die Clubkultur nicht, die fehlt dort. Und deshalb sitzen sie alle oft in Europa. Sie, Ellen. Naja, aber jetzt geht's mal zur Sache. Das war nur so eine kleine Introduction. Und wir sind also vom Tresor dem Detroit Techno sehr... sehr eng verbunden, auch sehr handwerklich von Michigan. War nicht einziger, sag ich mal, die ernstzunehmenden Produzenten damals waren Basic Channel in Berlin, aber alles andere war noch nicht da, das dauerte lange. Deshalb thank you Detroit very much, you know, thank you Korn. Don't move to Berlin. The city is fully packed, you know, from creatives, you know.
It's not gone.
Anyway, thank you very much for listening. And
thank you, Dimi. Maybe this is the perfect moment for a tiny little quote from Juan Atkins, who said, "When we first came to Berlin, it looked like Detroit. They looked like sister cities." But of course, he was talking about that part of Berlin that was like post-war, post-Mauerfall. Kind of desolate, but that changed. Now it's totally all gentrified. Anyways, but we want to talk about Detroit first. And while we were having a very good, nice little dinner, we came to the core of Detroit, which was the Music Institute. And we found that both Alan and Minx were guests there. And maybe it's really worth describing it a little bit, talking about the Music Institute. What was special about it? Who wants to go first? Ladies first.
Ladies first, always.
Thank you so much. You're such a gentleman. I love these guys.
Yes, I am.
I've been treated royally all day. I love this. Hi, everybody. So the Music Institute, well, first let me say that I didn't really know techno. I heard it on the radio on FM 98, and I know repetitively there was a DJ, Stacy Hot Wax Hill and Derek May, back and forth, DJing live online. And when I heard it, I would change the channel because it was just sounding like too much for me. It wasn't that type of music. And one night, because I had the apartment downtown where everybody came to hang out, so one night, they're like, let's go to the Music Institute. And our program, I didn't know. He said, no, it's a club. So it's like 8 of us. And I'm 6'1", and my friends are like 6'5", 6'6". And when we got there, there's a line down, I'm letting you in. No, you can come in, and you can come in. No, you can't come in. Like Studio 54 in New York. So then I'm like, I'm hearing that it's the same kind of music, but I don't care at this point. I want to get in. So I'm like, we have to get in here. And he's like, no, you don't have a membership. And so we're huddling around. We're trying to figure out what to do to get into the Music Institute. And he liked that we were all tall and towering over everybody. He says, yeah, you guys can come in. And when we went in, and it was dark, the pathway, when you first walked in, and then you paid and talked to a gentleman, and there was a curtain covering the entire, kind of made like this room. Like, this is the entrance, and this is all covered. And you just heard this loud thud. And when you went on the other side of the curtains were almost soundproof. So it was like keeping a lot of the noise out from the hallway. I was shaking because that was the first time I had ever seen anything like it. People jumping around, dancing hard, and screaming. And then I look up and there's a DJ. Wild ass Derek May. up there in the booth, jumping around, making, you know, stopping the music. They stop, turn it back on, they scream. And he was pretty much running this crowd. And it was very interesting to me, and I fell in love immediately. I was like, oh my goodness, I live right down the street. We have to go here every week. So one of my best friends lived in the apartment with me, and she started saying, let's go back to the Institute place. So I started going back every week. And then one day, I wanted to go up. So I climbed the ladder to go and see the DJ. I didn't know where I was going, but I know that that was the only entrance to, you know, where he was. He was on the next level. So I went in and I was watching him. And I'd watch him for a little bit, and he turned around and he said, what are you looking at? And I was just like, I can do that. And so then I left, and I was like, why did I even say anything? Because I'm just very shy. I truly am.
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, I am. And so a couple of weeks later, I didn't go the next week, but up there, but I was at the club. So a week after that, I went back to the booth. And he looked and he's like, are you doing this yet? And I said, no. And he said, well, don't come back until you're doing it. And I left. And I told my mentor, and I was like, that guy, Derek May, said to me not to come back to the DJ booth unless I was DJing. And I was only joking. And he's like, well, you have to start DJing. I'm like, I can't do it. I was just joking. And 2 weeks later, my friend came, buzzer downstairs, and I'm like, who is it? He's like, it's Jerry. And I buzzed him in. He comes in with boxes. What are you doing? What are you doing? They're saying nothing to me. He's like, put that there. He's only talking to Dwayne, right? Taking out turntables, plugging them in, getting a mixer, plugging that in, plugging the speaker. I'm like, what are you guys doing? I don't want it. I don't want this stuff. I was only, you know, joking. They set up the whole system. There was some JVC turntables, a small mixer. I don't remember what kind it was, but they set the whole thing up. Jerry said to me, here's two records.
He held them up.
Mix them. When you're done mixing them, call me. I said, Jerry, I can't. And he left. They left. And I left that setup there for weeks. I did not do anything with it. And then one day I sat down. Well, it's because I called Jerry. And I'm like, hey, did you mix those records? No. And I called him. Did you mix the records? I said, I mixed them. He said, okay, we can talk. I'll be over there in a minute. He brought me two different records. Mix those. Call me. It was 100% Dissing by Armand Van Helden, I think. Armando.
Yeah.
Flash. Those two tracks he wanted me to mix. You know how fast Flash is on KMS? Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And then he brought more records, and he was like, okay, now you got it. So I started mixing them, and I got smooth with it. That's how, first of all, because of watching Derek, I played my music so fast. I played it in a techno speed, but it was mostly house, because I liked the soul sound of it. I liked the Detroit sound in the music. So when I went to the record store, that's all I bought. So my experience with the Music Institute was, that was my invitation to actually wanting to become a DJ and then doing it. Well, I was bullied into it a little bit, but I truly wanted to be a DJ, and that's just watching Derek was my ticket in.
And the rest is history.
Well, I also kind of came into it through Derek, because, you know, we had been friends forever and ever, like since we were, he's gonna start a juice bar downtown, and it's gonna be all house and techno. And he kind of let me know he was gonna do it. And they ended up doing it. So, you know, I did like a poster for Music Institute. That's kind of how I kind of slid in there, because I did a poster for them. And they gave me a membership card because I did the art. So I would go there. I was doing my radio show at the time. Mm-hmm. I was on WDET. So my radio show was on from midnight to 3 a.m. And then at 3 a.m., I'd get off the air. I put the records away in the library. I go straight to Music Institute. And 3 a.m. is when Derek will come on, like 2 o'clock or something like that. And then that's when Derek will come on. And, you know, so I would just go straight down. At the time, this is when Acid House was happening in England. And all this music was kind of coming back to Detroit. And this is the only place you could hear this stuff. And, you know, when I was growing up in Detroit, you know, you're just fascinated with London. Oh, my God, London. So here I knew a guy that was going back and forth to London and bringing back these records and then playing them at this club. And then that's kind of how I got inspired, because I watched Derek too, you know, and he'd all the theatrics, you know, he'd just kill it up there, you know.
Wild child.
You know, and I kind of was like, I was doing a radio show, but for me it was boring. And, you know, you look at this guy, he's like crushing it. So that was kind of the beginning of my kind of career detour, which we're still on, like 35 years later. But so I would go to MI, like for Shea Damiere and Alton Miller. I would go to Todd's first, and then go to the Music Institute. You know, Todd's. It was a new wave club every Thursday night, and then every Saturday night it was gay. But in those days, that was the only place you could hear house music. You had to go to a gay club. So I would go, me and Derek would go there, just to hear Ken Collier, you know. And and this is when mixing was new also. So you went and you could hear it actually mixed, like a DJ actually mixing. And that's kind of how I got more into trying to mix myself, just watching these guys. But Music Institute, for me, it was this community of creative black youth, and everybody got to contribute. You know, I was doing the art stuff and people were DJing, and there is an artist, a painter. Sarah did like this mural at the MI, which was there. It was there for years. Like even after they shut the club, it was still there. So it was just, for me at that age, it seemed like there was something going on in my hometown that was really exciting, and people were really, you know, really doing it. And one of the things that really got me, I know you remember this, when Dave Gahan went to Derek May's loft, and and Martin El Gore, yeah, and they went to his loft, and there was pictures in the paper of Derek hanging out with Depeche Mode, right? Yeah. Oh, and I'm like, so this guy that I know, I mean, I'm in my early 20s, right? And this guy that I know is knowing, you know. And then you read Melody Maker. And this guy is DJing at the Hacienda with New Order. And it's this cat that I knew when we were like 10. And I'm like, this just opened up so many kind of possibilities that you didn't think could happen in Detroit. Because back then you had to go to New York.
Yes.
You know, mm-hmm. But this stuff
or
was
Chicago.
Happening. Well, no.
Not so much.
In the 80s, it was New York. It was, in the 80s, it was New York. It was Keith Haring, Basquiat, Warhol, Schnabel, you know, Studio 54. I mean, it was New York, Blondie. But something like that was beginning to happen where I lived. That was the whole concept of it. So that's what MI was to me. I mean, above and beyond the music, it was this crew of that's what got me involved in music. Because I was doing comics before. Mm-hmm. You know, I was just like a little comic artist nerd. But then I started seeing these guys making these moves. I'm like, I got to do something like that.
was a short-lived place, but left a very big footprint, apparently.
Absolutely.
To this day. Cornelius, you're also a scholar, I might say, of techno-culture. And I would like to ask you, like, how did people in Detroit exist? So there was at least one radio guy who is still alive, actually, called himself the Electrifying Mojo. How influential was he, and how much did he put into the...
Any words to describe the influence and the impact of the Electrifying Mojo. This was a radio DJ, late night DJ, and he actually started in the 70s. And so, you know, some of our parents, you know, grew up rational type of experience to discover this guy that your parents already knew about. and one of the great things about Mojo is that, well, one of the things I always talk about is how, because he had made a comment, I don't know how much of the U.S. music history that you're aware of, but radio and records and everything was segregated in the United States. And so if you were a black artist, those were called race records. And then if it was a radio station that would play black music, it was called a race station. And so eventually radio became desegregated, but Mojo made a comment about how he would notice of all of these white people who would be listening to Marvin Gaye and Funkadelic, but then he would see all these black people listening to Rolling Stones and Aerosmith, and he said, why segregated when we're listening to the same stuff? And so he started playing all this together, and he became incredibly popular. That's what led to him coming to Detroit with WGPR and creating the Midnight Funk Association, which is his radio show. Mojo was very open in terms of style and genre. And I'm going to say, as far as, you know, a lot of what I learned was, you know, hearing Kraftwerk and Falco and Alexander Robotnik or whoever, along with Peter Frampton, along with, you know, say in terms of education, he educated people to music and what tied all of these different styles of music together. And I think he opened a lot of people's minds in terms of what was possible. Because what happens is people get put into boxes and you think, well, this is what I can do right here. And in fact, I have a friend who is into punk rock. He's black. But he said that Mojo is actually the one who opened his mind up to it, because he always thought he could only listen to R&B. He thought, he grew up thinking that that was as big as his musical world could be. And he said that Mojo taught him that he could listen to, enjoy, be a part of anything. And so I think that it really opened and set the stage for a lot of what happened, you know, moving forward, I think, because I think he opened up, like, because when you're talking about the entire city, the entire region, the whole, because the broadcast range was the entire, he opened up to the idea that this was possible, that this is something that's real and it's okay. And it's something that we can and should engage with. So Mojo, to me, he was a door. He opened a door to a lot of incredible things that came afterwards.
Okay. The doors of perception, or the door to Tresor, which you can now see in the Humboldt Forum in Berlin, famous big museum. Minx, what did it feel like? I mean, you already introduced us a little bit to your mindset when you first came to the Music Institute, but how did your perspective on the scene change when you, because we the first chapter was you learned to DJ, but then what happened? How did that change your outlook on the music and on the people that made it?
Well, I needed to be educated myself at that point because, of course, listening to the music, I started going to the record store, learning from producers in Detroit. Because since the music was born there,